following podcast is brought to you by Robots vs. Dinosaurs.
Disclaimer, this podcast is about to spoil several movies from 6 to 20 years old. Lou, read off the list.
Today, Robots vs. Dinosaurs will be spoiling for you, the listener. Barbie, Gladiator, SpongeBob SquarePants, Fear the Walking Dead, Parks and Recreation, Rebels, Andor, The Book of Boba Fett, The Mandalorian, and every single Star Wars movie. Hello and welcome to Robots vs. Dinosaurs, the podcast where we watch a movie
or a TV show
and then try to determine which one is cooler, robots, dinosaurs, or repurposed HK droids with capes, which are robots, so I guess that answers it. I'm your host, Luigi. And with me, as always, for this upcoming Ahsoka series is my intrepid co-host, Evan Norris. Evan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I had a total blast breaking down The Mandalorian Season 3, and I'm really happy to be back to break down Ahsoka and its place in the larger Star Wars television universe. And I'm pumped to jump into it.
Yeah, so Ahsoka is a Disney Plus Star Wars show. I'm sure you know if you're listening to this, because we're assuming that you've seen it, or that you're just curious about it. But it came out in August of 2023, and I just want to get this out of the way. It's big spoilers. We are going to be talking about the entire show as a whole. We're assuming that you've seen it, or that you don't mind being spoiled, because we want to talk about it as a complete project. And the way we're going to do that is each of these episodes that you're listening to, we're going to cover two episodes at a time. So this is one of four episodes where we're going to be covering Ahsoka. Ahsoka, of course, is directed by Dave Filoni for the most part, but we'll talk about episodes. And as a matter of fact, episode two is directed by Steph Green. But for the most part, also written by Dave Filoni, and George Lucas is credited as well. It stars Rosario Dawson, David Tennant, Natasha Lou Bordezeau, and Mary Elizabeth Winstead, among others that we will definitely get into. Evan, as a whole, where would you rank Ahsoka in your like Disney Plus Star Wars show listings?
It's a great question. I've thought about this a lot. And for me, at least the season one, it's sort of right in the middle for me at the moment. I think season one is building up towards something special. It kind of reminds me of the first season of The Clone Wars, where it was a struggle to get through that first season. Although it wasn't a struggle to get through the first season of Ahsoka, but Clone Wars really built to something special. And I think as you leave Ahsoka season one, you're expecting season two to really punch you in the mouth. But I think there's a lot of setup and a lot of foundation setting in season one. So I'd probably put it kind of in the middle. I'm excited for season two, but I'd probably put above it Mando season one, Mando season two, Andor, and probably Obi-Wan. I really enjoyed Obi-Wan. I think it's kind of in the middle, building towards something special. But that's where I see it at the moment. How about you?
Absolutely. I would say I really loved it. I was thrilled almost every moment of it. Going back and watching it the second time, I appreciated some of the building and the slow boil stuff they did a little bit more. That said, I do have a few moments I want to point out where I was like worried in this first episode, where I was like worried about where things were going. And I remember that fear the first time I was watching it, like, oh no, is this going to be another Book of Boba Fett? And we'll talk about those when we get to them. But overall, I think as a complete picture, this is a beautiful show. Ahsoka's always been one of my favorite Jedi characters in the Star Wars galaxy. And I think Rosario Dawson is just it's a home run. Like, it's such good casting. We'll talk about why once we dive in, but, I would say obviously better than Book of Boba Fett. Not quite the masterpiece that Andor was. So somewhere on the same level as Mando. Mando's had more time to cook, so Ahsoka could reach those heights. We'll see. But that's around where I'd rank it
Okay. Yeah. And another thing I'd add, and I'm sure you agree, is that, and part of the reason, audience out there, that this recording is coming so late after the show came out, and that is on me, because I desperately wanted to finish both the Clone Wars series and Rebels to prepare for this. And I am so, so glad I did, because, and I think you'll agree, Ahsoka is kind of Rebels. It's a sequel series to Rebels. And I would be, I think if you are listening to this and you've watched Ahsoka, or if you're preparing to watch Ahsoka, absolutely the Clone Wars will give you a great foundation with Ahsoka and her story and her saga. But Rebels will kind of introduce you to a lot of the characters that orbit Ahsoka in this series. In fact, anyone who's watched The Bad Batch, and that's something I'm watching right now, thanks to Lou's recommendation, in the pilot episode of Bad Batch, it starts with the Clone Wars title card and it kind of burns up and turns into the Bad Batch logo. I love that. They could have done the same thing. They could have had Rebels burn up into Ahsoka, because this really feels like a continuation. To the point, and we'll get to this in later episodes, sometimes Ahsoka gets a little buried in her own show, but that's not so much the case in these first two episodes.
I totally agree with that. One of the biggest criticisms and pieces of praise when this show was out that I was reading online and you know, hearing about, is simultaneously that this is basically live-action Rebels. I'm a huge Rebels fan. I think you became a pretty big Rebels fan when you watched it recently. So this was a delight for me to see these characters come to life. I think the casting is just across the board fantastic in Ahsoka. But I did hear from folks that never watched Rebels and tried to watch this show that they were baffled by a lot of things, that they felt left behind, that they felt excluded, and that they felt like this wasn't made for me, this wasn't made for everybody, this was made for Rebels fans. So as a Rebels fan, it's really hard for me to look at this show objectively. I'll admit that right off the top. So, you know, I'm going to try my best to temper my love for this show and talk about it in with a little bit of a critical eye. But I think as a live action continuation of Rebels, we couldn't have asked for, well, there's one big thing, if they had given us more Zeb. But other than that, we couldn't really have asked for more of like a better next season of Rebels, but live action than this. That said, I do think it fits into the overall Filoni-verse, and this current era of Star Wars really well. I think it sets up things that Mandalorian is also, you know, exhausting itself to try to do to apologize for things in the sequel trilogy. But it also doesn't get bogged down by that. And I don't know. I think it's great. But again, I'm very biased, and I'll admit that.
That's okay. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I've been watching Clone Wars and Rebels and with my wife, and she suggested, half jokingly, there should be a disclaimer at the beginning of Ahsoka. If you haven't yet watched Rebels, pause now, go back. So I think there's some truth to that. But you're right, it is kind of a live action Rebels, and you mentioned the casting and the characterization. So I'd love to hand it over to you to dive a little deeper into why you think the casting choices were so spot on.
And one more thing, listeners, stay tuned, because at the end of this episode, Evan and I actually have an exclusive insider look on a new Disney Plus Star Wars show that, I don't know, we gotta be careful about how much we talk about it because of NDAs and stuff like that, but yeah, just stay tuned at the end. We're going to talk about that later. So I will argue, you know, I think a lot of that criticism is valid. Like, oh, I haven't seen Rebels, so that's a barrier to entry on Ahsoka. But, you know, the original Star Wars trilogy, obviously it wasn't always Episode 4. It was just, you know, Star Wars at one point before it became, you know, Episode 4, A New Hope. However, it is structured in such a way that, like, Obi-Wan is this mysterious character. You only find out bits and pieces about him, and he mentions these things about these heroes from this past war. And it's a lot of mystery, and it's a lot of, like, you know, scarce information that has a payoff towards the end. But arguably, you don't need to have watched the prequel trilogy to get what's going on in Star Wars, what is now called Episode 4. When it came out, it was a complete thing. I think that there is a world where if you just go into Ahsoka with that mindset, like, nothing came before this, everything that's referenced in it is going to pay off. I don't know who this Ezra Bridger guy is. Am I supposed to know who he is? I do think, like, when they introduce him later in the show, you get a full picture of who this guy is. Like, you don't need to have watched Rebels. It's delightful if you have. I think, like, you get more of, like, oh, yeah, that's such an Ezra thing, or, like, oh, that's so, that payoff between him and Sabine, like, that's so great. But I don't know. I can't look at this objectively, only subjectively. But I do think, like, you could just kind of roll with it and be like, yeah, what they're doing with the pieces on the board is enough for a self-contained thing. Do you think that's true, or do you think that we're biased and blinded by our love for Rebels?
I'm probably somewhere in the middle. I do think the writing, and it's just talking about these first two episodes, the writing in episodes 1 and 2 is crafty enough to suggest who these characters are and what their relationships are without relying too heavy on exposition. You know, I always joke that a lot of these TV shows will be two people who have known each other for 10 years will talk to each other like, as you know, I am the Supreme Allied Commander of the New Republic. Like, yeah, I know. I know, Mon Mothma. Why are you telling me that? Are you telling the audience? So,
how long have we been brothers again?
Right. Ahsoka is written cleverly where there's, you know, Hera will talk to us. There's this moment in episode 1 or maybe 2 where Hera says Ahsoka is lamenting the frustrating relationship she has with her one-time Padawan, Sabine. And Hera says something like, I'm sure it wasn't always easy with your master. And Ahsoka kind of turns away and says, I never finished my training with Anakin. And that line just says, oh, okay. So if I didn't watch any of Clone Wars, I'd suddenly realize, oh, Anakin had a Padawan. This is her. That means something. So there are little lines sprinkled throughout episodes 1 and 2 that kind of establish these relationships. So I would say, if I didn't know what Rebels was, I wouldn't be completely lost. But I definitely couldn't appreciate it as much as someone like you and me who pored over the whole Rebels series, had those emotional moments with these characters. So I'm probably somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, so this first episode is called Master and Apprentice. And that's one of the huge themes in it that I think plays throughout, that they really focus on, is that idea of, you know, Ahsoka and Hera have that conversation about the Master and Apprentice relationship between her and Anakin. You know, she never finished her training. And then right after that, she laments that, you know, and she walked away from training her Padawan. So you can tell, like, she's questioning what's unsaid there. She's questioning, am I going to turn out like Anakin? Am I going to turn to the dark side? And that's something she struggles with throughout the rest of the show. There's an episode coming up. Again, if you've seen the show, I cannot wait to talk about. You know exactly which one I'm talking about. Where that they dive fully into that. So I'm going to save it all discussion for when we get to that episode. But yeah, like it's not only Ahsoka and Sabine as Master and Apprentice, but also the first main characters that we get introduced to, Baylan Skoll and Shin Hati.
Oh yeah.
AKA Darth Ron Swanson and Darth Billie Eilish. Baylan Skoll is played by the late Ray Stevenson. Just pour one out for this amazing actor.
Rest in peace.
Absolutely. Like, what we lost. What, I don't know if they're... I've heard that they're going to recast. Maybe Liev Schreiber is being talked about. A couple names are being talked about. Because the way that they kind of left his character at the end of the season, it's setting up so much.
So much.
And then Ivana Sokno plays Shin Hati, a perfect casting. Both of these characters, they're incredible. This episode of Master and Apprentice opens with a scroll. The evil Galactic Empire, all caps, has fallen, and a New Republic, all caps, has risen to take its place. However, sinister agents are already at work to undermine the fragile peace. We get this the first shot is a Republic cruiser, the like rounded as opposed to angular shape cruising through space, and then an Imperial shuttle shows up, and it's Ray Stevenson and Darth Billie Eilish, and they have hoods. There's like the captain on the Republic ship is like, oh, are they? They're identifying themselves as Jedi, and when they get off, he asks his droid RD3 to scan them, and Baylan Skoll just goes, allow me to show you our identification, and they pop their lightsabers and kill everybody on board their ship. And he also has another cool line where he's like, you were right about one thing, Captain. We all know Jedi. This is just such a great introduction to two characters that are going to be our minor antagonists throughout the series. Mm. I don't know how... Yeah, would you say, like, they're major villains, minor antagonists? Where would you rank them?
That's interesting. I guess technically, like, if you want to apply it to the James Bond template, you know, I guess the big bad is Morgan Elsbeth. Baylan Skoll is like the odd job, kind of the main henchman, I suppose. But I hesitate
even then,
to use
Morgan,
them.
Morgan is the big bad for only a couple episodes, and then there's an even bigger bad.
Oh,
right.
That's very true. Setting up one of the Star Wars series' greatest villains, which I can't wait to talk more about that. But yeah, I agree. So Ray Stevenson. Obviously he's just too young to pass, and that's a tragedy. And he contributed a lot to a lot of great movies, a lot of great performances, but Baylan Skoll, one of my favorite characters from this season, Ray Stevenson's mm-hmm. performance, so subtle, so sad in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's really especially tragic because one of the things I'm so desperate to see in season two is where Skoll's character goes. And I'm really going to miss Stevenson because he added this amazing depth to that character who didn't have much screen time. Every time he was on the screen, I was mesmerized. So you were talking about great casting, great performance. That's a brilliant casting move. He has this line at the very end of season two, or sorry, pardon me, not season two, episode two, where he's lamenting the potential future death of Ahsoka and says, there are so few Jedi left. He's not even really loyal to the Jedi. He turned away from that path, but he's mm-hmm. got this like nostalgic yearning for them, having survived
Order
66.
Like, sentimental.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, truth.
Right. So I think the acting kind of across the board, pretty solid, especially him, especially Dawson. So I'm excited to see where that character goes. But yeah, he made a big impression on me in episodes 1 and 2. As did Dawson, as did Tennant, as Hu Yang. Yeah, what are some other characters that really... I'd love to hear your thoughts on, like, the transition, like, animated Hera to live-action Hera, animated Sabine to live-action Sabine. Like, in general, where do you think those landed, those casting choices?
Okay, I've said this before, and I'll say it again. Harrison Dula behind the wheel of any aircraft, any spacecraft, is easily one of the most dangerous people in the Star Wars galaxy. Mm. I would rank her. I want to rank Star Wars pilots, and Hera. I'm just gonna say it. Hera's my number one. Like up there with. Poe Dameron, up there with Anakin himself, up there. I don't know who else might be on the short list, but Hera is at the top for me. Like she this show showcases that really well. She only gets a handful of cool moments, but they're all phenomenal. Rebels, it seemed like almost every episode, Hera and Chopper were jumping in the Phantom or the Ghost, and like just destroying everything around them. like as easily as sneezing. And I think Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Listen, I'm going to try to keep it classy, because I've had a big crush on her for years. I don't know if you've seen, like, 10 Cloverfield Lane
or
Birds of Prey. She was fantastic in that. I just have such a big crush on this actress, and I think she's perfect casting. To me, it's maybe the smoothest transition from the animated character to the live action one. Just everything about the way she stands with one hand on her hip, her voice, her attitude, her confidence when she's flying, her relationship with Chopper. It's perfection. I would love to ask Mary Elizabeth Winstead, like, how much she's watched Rebels, like, to get the mannerisms and the voice patterns of the character, or how much she studied it. But I don't know if she did. Maybe she didn't. Maybe she's just that good at interpreting the character off the page. But what do you think?
Yeah, well, I'll start with Hera. So I remember we had some text conversations during Rebels when I was fawning over Hera just as a character in the animated series in Rebels, and you were saying how she's a great pilot, and she's definitely up there. I mean, I'd probably put Anakin/Vader above her. There's this scene in Rebels where Vader on his own, like, jumps into a Rebel fleet clustered somewhere just in his advanced TIE fighter and takes them, like, mm-hmm. takes out, like, 8 A-wings, and he's, like, flipping around. You know, it's bonkers. But again, full dark side of the Force. As far as non-Force sensitive characters, I can't think of a better pilot than Hera, especially in Rebels. She just, her flying chops are off the chart. But
yep, she, and you, now that you've seen all of Rebels, she invented the Holdo maneuver a generation before Admiral Holdo used it.
Yeah, she was born to fly. And as I'm watching The Bad Batch season one, she makes an appearance there, and as a young child who already looking up at the stars and desperate to fly. So she's born to do it. Yeah, Winstead, great. On Wikipedia, if it's to be trusted, said Winstead looked back at Hera's character development on Rebels to kind of inform her performance, which makes sense because it's pitch perfect. And yeah, it's great seeing her. Stevenson, as we were talking about, great. Dawson's great. The first time we met her in season 2 of Mandalorian as Ahsoka, it made sense. She's just got the look. She's got the attitude. But I think she wasn't, correct me if I'm wrong, or I'd love to get your take, in season 2 of The Mandalorian, I think Dawson was still finding the character. Here she's found her, right? This is like years after the rebellion, years after the Empire's fallen. She's a little quieter. She's a little wiser. She's a little more solitary. It kind of makes sense on where that character's gone. So I think Dawson brings this precision to Tano, not only in her fighting, which is beautiful to watch, that two-handed fighting style, very silky, very smooth, but she brings this elegance and quiet dignity to the character where she chooses her words really carefully. There's a lot of pauses and silences with her, which I like. So Dawson's great. As for Bordizzo, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, as Sabine. I think
Natasha Lou Bordizzo.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. Sabine's kind of an elusive character. I think Sabine's also someone who's reluctant to sit still for too long, which makes sense. She was a dropout from the Imperial Academy, understandably. She tried bounty hunting, dropped out of that. She joined the Rebellion. That ended. She tried to train as a Jedi, dropped out of that, although I think Ahsoka kind of dropped her. So this character has trouble attaching to like projects, even though she's very attached to people. So
she held the Darksaber at one point and then, you know, just gave it away because she didn't want that mantle of responsibility.
So it's a tough character to portray. You know what I mean? It's there's a lot of layers with Sabine. Bordizzo, I think, does a competent job, although I need to see maybe more of her in season 2. And then other than that, I got to talk about Tennant. So David Tennant, who I adore, He's an amazing actor, but he voices Hu Yang. I'm so glad Hu Yang survived Order 66 mm-hmm. and survived over the years. Essentially, for those who haven't seen Clone Wars, he was introduced there, I believe, for the first time as kind of the droid who's lived for a millennia, mm-hmm. helping young Padawans construct their first lightsabers. And so now he is traveling with Ahsoka throughout the stars as a droid, kind of a wise droid, a logical droid, that kind of a dry sense of humor. And I think Tennant just brings amazing humanity to that droid role. So I think that's a big win. So yeah, in general, casting spot on, the performance is spot on. Diane Lee Inosanto as Morgan Elsbeth, kind of hard to pin. I don't know. I feel like I don't really know that character, and now she's gone. Yeah. So I don't know if that was a writing issue or acting issue.
I liked her performance a lot, but one of my biggest criticisms of this show is Morgan Elsbeth was the most wasted character. I think they did her kind of dirty. And it's a shame because I think Diana Lea Inosanto does such a good job of playing it somewhere between this is a live action cartoon. Like every once in a while, she just has this like, I'm going to smirk into the camera.
So much smirking.
And, you know, yeah. and also, I don't know, just like giving us some historical facts about something that is absolutely insane to wrap your mind around, which is space witches. In a world where we already have space wizards and you know, laser swords, but it's like, it's that extra little element of like, okay, she's been tasked with selling the audience this crazy thing. And I think she does a good job of it. I think when we get to the episode where, you know, she's just dismissed from the show, we'll talk about it more, but I think she was done pretty dirty. I want to go back to Natasha Liu Bordizzo for just a second. I like her portrayal of Sabine. I like this. Sabine is a great character. I loved her on Rebels. I have her Black Series action figure, and it's awesome. She is such a, like, even on Rebels, especially on Rebels, I should say, such a, like, action figure character. Like, she's got, you know, the cool guns and holster. She has the coolest armor.
Yeah.
She's an artist, and, like, the way she... Has there... Quick sidebar. Has there ever been, like, a character in Star Wars that one of their main personality traits is artist before Sabine, before or after Sabine?
I can't think of off the top of my head that she might have been the first. I mean, putting graffiti on everything, and that endures into Ahsoka. You see little Loth cats printed on her bunk bed and, mm-hmm. and everywhere. Her helmet, her Mandalorian. Yeah, she's such an interesting character. She's a Mandalorian. Mandalorians are very stern, focused, utilitarian, I guess, for lack of a better word. But she adorns her Mando armor with this lovely art. That mural she built on Lothal. Yeah, it's... she might be the first and last artist. Although, I guess, the chief antagonist of Rebels and now of Ahsoka, Grand Admiral Thrawn, is certainly a coveter of the arts. Although there's like this dark side to that where the art is kind of... He studies the art to understand the culture so that it can be destroyed, making him a very interesting villain. I've always loved him. But,
and that makes them great, like, bookends or great antagonists for each other.
Well said.
I love Sabine. I love Sabine.
Yes.
I hate her in these first two episodes. Well, in the first episode. I hate her in the first episode. There's another decision that she makes later that I despise. But not because I think it's bad writing, but because I think it's like, God, Sabine, come on.
Yeah.
I get why she would be at this place mentally at that point. I get why she would make this terrible, terrible decision to, you know, Ahsoka brings her the key that she finds on what's it called? That planet, the witch ruins planet that she's exploring. I'm sure I wrote it down somewhere.
This might be a good time. I could kind of, for the audience, I could summarize the first episode. And we could kind of
break down
the plot points. And thanks, Wikipedia, for your support in this summary. But as Lou mentioned, Baylan Skoll, who is kind of a mercenary, a former Jedi, and his apprentice, Shin Hati, they assault a New Republic cruiser to take back Morgan Elsbeth, who Ahsoka had gone to the trouble of capturing. While that rescue attempt is going on, Ahsoka is on this planet who's, you know, did you find the name?
Arcana.
Well done. Yeah. this mysterious uninhabited planet with this old temple, this old kind of space witch temple. And there's this very Indiana Jones-esque scene where Ahsoka is like slowly moving through the temple ruins and trying to uncover the map. She gets the map, which is like this, you know, the size of like a softball made from this, looks like pewter. And this is a star map. She doesn't know how to open it. So while that rescue attempt for Morgan Elsbeth is successful, Ahsoka finds this map. She chats with Hera Syndulla, who we've chatted about, who's now a general. And Syndulla, who's great friends with both Ahsoka and with Sabine, suggests, hey, you know who could help you decipher that map? Sabine. So we cut back to Lothal, where we spent episodes and episodes of the Rebel series, where there's a kind of a celebration of the independence, the redemption, the saving of Lothal at the end of the Rebel show. Sabine is meant to be kind of the keynote speaker, but she's like, to hell with that. I'm a free spirit. She jumps on her speeder bike. She goes back to the radio tower where Ezra grew up. Ezra, who's kind of a brother to her and who disappeared at the end of Rebels. And Ahsoka finds her. She gives her the map. And let me see. I want to make sure I'm getting all the plot points right. So there's this charged moment in Ahsoka's ship where it's revealed that Sabine used to train under Ahsoka. They both kind of gave up on each other. Sabine says, I'll help you decipher this map, but I need to do it on my own time in my own space. Ahsoka says, the map stays here. You're not going anywhere. In kind of the most, not in a mean way, but just a protective way. Sabine needs the space. She goes back to the radio tower, deciphers the map, but at that same moment, she's assaulted by that Padawan.
Shin Hati.
Thank you.
Darth Billie Eilish
and her robots with capes, because that makes them cooler and more dangerous. And Billie Eilish stabs Sabine with her lightsaber, absconds with the map, and I think that's where we leave it. In episode one.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that moment when she is like, I want to, you know, take a look at this key and like take it somewhere where I can think. And Ahsoka's like, no, it stays on the ship. She could use the whole ship. She could use any room in the ship. She could ask Ahsoka to leave the ship. Like anything, any other option than let me take it away and do explicitly what you told me not to do. And then, you know, So here's what redeems Sabine for me, because again, like I said, I don't think it's bad writing. I don't think it doesn't make me do a 180 on how I feel about the character. I do think it's like a petulant kind of thing that she would do, thinking that she's totally in the right. And in several episodes of Rebels, she does stuff like that and is proven right. This is an instance where she is immediately proven wrong and Ahsoka was correct to be worried about what she was worried about. But Sabine has the grace in the next episode to admit that this is a bad call, and she apologizes. So I don't know. I think it's like it made me angry both times I watched it happen, but for the reason that like it should make you upset. It's frustrating to watch. But it's also real. So all that to say, I think Natasha Lou Bertuzzo, I think her look is fantastic. I think when she does cut her hair, it's like, oh, there's Sabine. There she is. Like, this is even... Like, when she has long hair and it's dyed three different colors, very Sabine, like, I'm into it. But, like, once she cuts it off, I'm like... And so that her hair can fit in her helmet better, I guess. And also, you know, it's that transformation scene in every 90s rom-com. It's...
Yeah.
I think it's just, like, perfection. And I don't know who could have been. I've never seen this actor in anything else, but I don't know who you could cast as Sabine that would do a better job. Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny. I have this vision of, like, Sabine showing up wearing glasses and her hair up in a bun, and Ahsoka, like, taking off the glasses, undoing the bun. Like, oh, you're beautiful. You can go to the space prom.
Yeah.
No, you go for it.
So two things I just want to mention about when we're introduced to Ahsoka in the show. One, she does the most Ahsoka Tano-ass thing ever, where she is right above the location she needs to be, and she slams her two lightsabers
yes.
down, spins them around with the Force, and drops down. I feel like we've seen her do exactly that move on Clone Wars multiple times.
As someone who just finished the final season of Clone Wars, she does that on board the Star Destroyer during Order 66. She and Rex are trying to escape, and she does that. I remember Beth and I, my wife, looked at each other and were like, oh my God, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. And then when she does it in the first episode, we were so happy.
Yeah. It immediately sold me on the idea of like, oh, they know what they're doing with this character. This is like... a mature version of her, but she still does these flashy, cool, like over-the-top moves, and I appreciate that so much. When she's in there and solving this Resident Evil puzzle, that's when I first got worried about the show, because that is a slow sequence.
I could not agree more. I totally agree. There's a lot of slowness to the first two episodes, to the point where I almost thought, Filoni's writing these. He's used to writing 22-minute long episodes. Now he's writing 44-minute long episodes. Like, does he not know how to cram in content? Because that was almost painfully slow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it felt like Resident Evil or like, you know, Zelda or something, where you're like, you're watching her churn the little thing. Oh, that little glowing thing lit up. Okay, awesome. That means if I churn this thing. And I'm like, I get it. I'm not solving this puzzle.
Right.
Just show me, like, just let's cut to the chase, please. Because the next thing that happens is awesome. The HK droids, which pop up multiple times throughout the series. I love the look of these droids. The capes are completely unnecessary, but General Grievous wore a cape.
Yep.
So who, you know, I'm not going to criticize that. I think it looks awesome. They are right to design them that way because it looks cool. And a lot of decisions in Star Wars have always been just about aesthetics. Do you get the sense, like, when you're looking at the silhouette of these HK droids, the way that their heads, their helmets are kind of designed, and the cape adding to it, do you get a sense, like, these were designed in some way to silhouette, like Anakin, like Darth Vader?
Oh, I hadn't thought of that.
They almost have that helmet shape, like...
They do give off this kind of Western vibe, you know, like the man with no name who's like with the poncho, like, you know, flapping in the dusty air. So I appreciate that, the aesthetic of that. They're not much of a match for Ahsoka, though, because she slices them up pretty fast.
Yeah. And she she takes care of five of them easily, which I do think, again, that's just setting up later when Sabine gets attacked, and she takes out one of them really easily, and almost takes out the second one. And then Ahsoka asks her pointedly, how many were there? And she's like, two, but I did this or that. I think it's just to show you like the power level difference between this trained, experienced, blooded Jedi, not Jedi, someone who walked away from the Jedi, but with Jedi training, versus somebody who barely got past the rank of Padawan, or didn't even complete her Padawan training, and how much trouble they have with just these assassin droids. But that is not, you know, that is not Sabine's only strong suit. She's also a good, like, tinkerer. She knows, you know, technology, and she's she's pivotal in the second episode for, like, when Ahsoka brings her the head of one of these droids, she's able to get a location from it. She's able to, you know, tinker with it to the point where it's about to explode, which is a fun sequence. But yeah, she has other strengths besides, you know, Jedi powers and swinging a lightsaber. But it's great because you need, if you want character development, you need to start somewhere. And I, again, like, I'm frustrated. I've said this a couple times. I'm frustrated with Sabine in the first episode,
yeah.
But I think that's a good character choice. And she does grow and develop and get better at things. And yeah.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And it's interesting you talk about kind of force sensitivity and strength in the force. There is some, I'd love to jump to episode 2 to talk a little bit about Sabine's force sensitivity.
Sure. I have one more thing to say about episode 1.
Go for it.
Which is that the ending of the episode when Sabine confronts Shin Hati, I feel like Shin could have killed her at any point in time in that fight.
I felt that too.
I think if Shin was a more experienced fighter, or a more experienced, whatever we want to, they're not Sith, whatever we want to call them. I think she would have killed Sabine right away because she would have known, this person does not know what they're doing.
Yep.
They're inexperienced. They're not a great fighter, with a lightsaber. They're not a great duelist, I should say, with a lightsaber. But I think Shin was holding back a little bit just because she's like, I've never encountered this person before. I'm not going to get too cocky or arrogant and assume that I can beat anybody. So I think she's, like, fighting a little bit defensively. If she had known right off the bat, like, oh, this is barely even a Padawan I'm fighting, I think she could have killed her instantaneously. I am confused as to why she didn't kill her once she's impaled, because it would have been just a flick of the wrist upwards or to the right or diagonally, and that would have ended Sabine. I get why she runs away, because Ahsoka's ship shows up a moment later. But once she's impaled, Sabine, that should have been it. Like, Shin should have just done a flourish and bisected her, right?
It's weird. In fact, I was watching that, and part of me, if I didn't know Filoni better and Disney better, I thought they might have killed Sabine there. And that would have been, like, sent Ahsoka off on, like, I don't know, a quest for revenge. That would have been a really interesting dark place to send her. But I think, again, Sabine, we all love Sabine. We want to see more of her. But yeah, that felt like, oh, for a split second, like, are they going to go there? And like, nah, they're not going to go there. But yeah, you're right. In that moment, she, in the logic of the episode, yes, she should have perished.
But it was a fun, I'm not going to say it was a good fight because it wasn't, it was very one-sided, but
yeah.
It was a good fight to watch.
And I think it does help, whoever's doing the choreography for these fight scenes, amazing job with Ahsoka with like the two-handed style and her footwork and everything, but whoever's doing it for Sabine, probably the same person, is equally great because it shows how untrained and how unsteady she is. You know, she can wield a sword, but she's not really balanced. As Obi-Wan would always say, like, when you don't have that balance, your enemy can just tip you over, both physically and kind of mentally. So, in that fight scene at the end of episode 1, we see she's not really a match for this, who's kind of not a fully trained Padawan. And then when we get into episode 2, there's that really interesting conversation with Sabine and Hu Yang, where he says very matter-of-factly, you know, I've seen thousands of Padawans come through over the last generation, and basically, your strength with the Force is the weakest of any of them, which
by
I think
a long shot.
Right, and which I think is really interesting. One, that makes sense. Mandalorians, I think, Jedi Mandalorians are exceedingly rare. Sabine's never really shown that much aptitude for the Force, except that she can wield the Darksaber, which is technically a lightsaber, right? Which suggests Bo-Katan might be Force-sensitive, too. We know Din Djarin can't handle the Darksaber to save his life.
Yeah, it's like a sledgehammer in his
right?
hands.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's like a piece of rebar with a concrete at the end trying to pick up.
like a Tears of the Kingdom.
Yes. So Sabine, what I love, what's very interesting is that Sabine is not really meant to be a Jedi. And Ahsoka, who never finished her training, is not really meant to be a Jedi either. And yet one is training the other. It's kind of set up for disaster, which I'm kind of here for. We always see like Jedi and Padawan training, which goes relatively well. These are like a master who's not meant to be a master, a Padawan who's not meant to be a Padawan, trying to like learn from each other. It's super interesting to me, but yeah, when we get into episode two, it's kind of clear that Sabine is not really Jedi material, but she wants to make it happen. You know, that episode two ends with her saying, "I'm ready," which is so powerful because earlier in that episode, we had that conversation between Ahsoka and Hera, where Hera says kind of half mockingly, "What does it mean when you say you're ready?" And Ahsoka says, "You just know." And so when Sabine says with authority, with confidence, "I'm ready," meaning I'm ready to be trained, that's a really powerful moment in episode two, which I like. It was the haircut.
That's how you know.
So she's like the reverse Samson. She cuts off her hair to gain tremendous power. So that's one thing in episode two, which really I like, that this master trainee, master Padawan relationship doesn't have a lot of inherent success built into it. They really have to work on it. That's what spoke to me the most from the second episode.
Yeah, the relationship between Baylan and Shin versus the relationship between Ahsoka and Sabine, even if like just their strength level and their power level wasn't so outmatched, just their unity, Baylan and Shin's unity. Shin doesn't question him, or when she questions what's going on, she questions Morgan's decision at one point, and Baylan's like, "Yeah, no, there's a reason behind all of this. Like, just trust in fate or trust in whatever, and we'll, you know, we have an end goal and we're gonna achieve it." And they're very like relaxed and calm when they talk to each other, and there's like a mutual respect. And Ahsoka and Sabine have that in moments, but for the most part, their relationship is tense and contentious. And so at this point, and I think this is again a good starting point, so we can see not only their individual skills develop, but their relationships develop. It's a good parallel. It's a good contrast, I should say. Because right now, if it was Baylan and Shin versus Ahsoka and Sabine 2-on-2, they'd wipe the orange, let's call them the orange Jedis, because that's the color of their lightsaber. The orange Jedi would just wipe the floor with these two. Hu Yang even talks about, like, they're lightsabers at one point. He says, like, he's analyzed them. Baylan is, for sure, based on his assessment, a former Jedi that was trained, that, like, you know, this has all of the trappings of a lightsaber that I would have taught a young student to build. And the one Shin made, he said, "I've never seen it. It doesn't match any of my records." But clearly, like, whoever built this one taught his Padawan how to build hers. And also, like, just the fact that, like, that is Shin's lightsaber. Sabine is using... She never built her own lightsaber. She's using her friend's lightsaber, her brother's lightsaber, Ezra. Not her, you know, biological brother, but her brother, functionally.
Yeah.
So there's... I don't know. There's a lot of... It just... The show keeps bringing up these parallels between these two pairs. And I just think it's so good. And watching it for a second time, it's the stuff that I really started to notice more and appreciate more. Why don't you give us a quick synopsis of part two, Toil and Trouble. Great episode name.
The whole series has great playful episode names. The final one, it's like kind of play on the line, the witch in the wardrobe. Whoever was in charge of that, kudos. So
what's that episode? What's that title?
Oh, I can't remember the exact.
Oh, I'm looking at it now. The Jedi, the Witch, and the Warlord. Oh, yeah.
Isn't that good stuff? Yeah. So in this episode, we have the Orange Crew, the Dark Jedi, the Orange Jedi, Skoll and Hati take that map that Hati had taken from Sabine to the planet Cetos, I think a new planet for we Star Wars geeks.
Red tree planet.
Yep. With the sheer cliff looking over the water. Very cool looking. So they go to Cetos, and that's where Elsbeth, you know, that space witch who is really interested in bringing Thrawn back to power. Elsbeth reveals that by using this map, that Thrawn is trapped in another galaxy. Same as Ezra, because Ezra had used the Purrgil, these space-faring giant whales who kind of traveled the hyperspace lanes. They had carried both Thrawn and Ezra to another galaxy. And this is actually, I'll just pause here. We'll talk about this, I'm sure, in future episodes. So exciting. You know, I'm as someone who's watched so many hours of Star Wars, it's exciting to see, like, not only a new planet, but an entirely new galaxy. This is kind of really, truly uncharted territory. So very exciting stuff. So as that's happening with the bad guys on Cetos, Ahsoka, with the help of Sabine, realizes that HK droid came from the one of Elsbeth's former Imperial factories on Corellia. We know Corellia is kind of the main shipyard for the Old Republic, then the Empire, then the New Republic. So Ahsoka and Hera go to the Corellian shipyards. This is, by the way, the first but not the last instance of Hera playing Captain Kirk. Anyone who's familiar with the original series of Star Trek, you know, every time there was a landing party, it would be the captain, the first officer, the chief medical officer, the chief, you know, chief everything, the engineer, like he needed to go down to the planet, along with like one red shirt who's going to get killed by the monster. There's no reason that the captain should be going. Hera, I think there's justification for Hera.
There are several reasons the captain shouldn't be going, right, as you've kind of pointed out. Yeah.
So Hera goes to investigate herself. I've been going back and forth, like, does it make sense? Hera's a general now, would she be? But Ahsoka's there to protect her. It could be the return of Thrawn. This is more justifiable than some of the future stuff, some of the future gallivanting that Hera does. But we'll get to that in future episodes. So Hera and Ahsoka go to Corellia, where they get this tour of the facilities, a little bit of Filoni-esque commentary on Empire versus Republic, which is kind of woven through season 3 of The Mandalorian. And so then there's this, it's revealed that one of the power cores or a hyperdrive core that's being built on Corellia is not intended for the Republic, but it's in fact intended for Morgan Elsbeth. There's a chase scene, a fight scene, some former Imperial loyalists try to stop Ahsoka. She dispatches them without trouble. Ultimately, the hyperdrive core and the ship carrying it get away. And they go to the planet Cetos to reunite with Elsbeth, but not before the heroics of one Chopper, the droid, everyone's maybe second favorite droid after R2. So the reappearance of Chopper is great. We'll talk about that. But Chopper and Hera managed to put a tracking bolt or a tracking, you know, nugget on top of that ship. So they realize it goes to Cetos, which sets up some adventures for episode 3. And let's see, it ends with, oh yeah, Sabine tells Ahsoka, I'm ready, via hologram. And she cuts her hair, does the reverse Samson. It ends with basically Elsbeth talking to the Orange Lightsaber crew and saying, like, the hyperdrive's going to finish the Eye of Sion, which is her ship, which will help get to that next galaxy. And it ends with Ahsoka and Sabine traveling into hyperspace together to head to Cetos to kind of stop that from happening. And that's the end of it.
Yeah. So a couple things that I want to touch on. Corellia, when we see it in this episode, you've of course seen Solo, A Star Wars Story.
Absolutely.
So the beginning of that takes place in Corellia. That's where Han Solo is from, right? Am I remembering that right?
Correct.
And the condition that Corellia is in that movie versus the condition that it's in now, I think it was a subtle thing, but I liked how they showed it. Like, it's more developed. It clearly has, there's more money, you know, just because of like all of the work that over the course of two wars now, that, you know, this place has been like a war factory. It just look, there's something about it that like, it looks cleaner. It looks nicer overall when we see it, in this show, you know, 30 years later, 40 something years later. And I thought that was just a good, like, visual, subtlety that Star Wars always excels at. And just how that tells, like, the story of this planet itself. Do you know what I mean? And when we get there and they're talking about, like, you know, Filoni is definitely going on this thing about, like, you know, insurrectionists within the New Republic, and there's, like, a small mutiny. This guy, Min Weaver, that's, like, the supervisor of this factory, he has this line that I think they say almost this exact same line in season 3 of The Mandalorian, where he says, like, there are ex-Imperials at every level of the New Republic government. And, you know, Ahsoka and Hera exchange this look as if they didn't already know that information.
Yeah.
But still, it's like this ominous thing, like, uh-oh, that's gonna be bad. That might lead to a new order, perhaps, a new First Order. But, yeah, it's one of those things where, like, this show, Andor, not so much Andor, because that's a different era, but, like, definitely season 3 of Mando, are really showing that, like, this is, and I think I said this when we talked about Mando, it's a criticism of, like, how we handled post-World War II, and we kind of took former Nazi scientists and officers and put them in, like, the CIA and put them into different levels of our government, and the way that that is paying off now with, like, neo-Nazism on the rise and stuff like that. So, like, I think Filoni's touching on those themes with this. It's almost unthinkable, but it happens in real life, and it's, like, it's almost unthinkable when you see it in the news. So, yeah. Min Weaver, just a quick sidebar. I like this actor. His name is Peter Jacobson. And the one other thing that I've seen him in is, I don't want to be clear, this is a terrible show, Fear the Walking Dead. he plays a rabbi. He's like one of the, you know, survivors of the zombie apocalypse, and he's a rabbi. And I don't know, I like him in this one little stint we get on Ahsoka, as the, like, oh, look at that, it's that information's classified. And his whole exchange with Hera that really gets to show off how badass she is. And she's like, well, I'm unclassifying it. I'm a general, so it's not classified for me. And just their whole back and forth is great. But yeah, it's the whole thing with, like, I love how he, like, casually refers to the hyperdrive as, like, an SSD hyperdrive core. And I think, you know, nerds like us would know that means Super Star Destroyer. Is what SSD stands for. Yeah, I'm sorry. I kind of went off on a tangent there.
No, I agree. I know that actor from a lot of things. I think he was in House for a while, but he's great. And that was, he really elevated that bit part. And I totally agree with you. I like the whole, one thing that Filoni has done has, I think, you know, when we were kids, it was like, and we were watching Empire and Jedi. It was like, oh, the evil Empire and the amazing Republic that you know, saved the galaxy and that kind of thing. And I think Filoni, throughout season 3 of Mando and now in this, although sometimes he goes a little too heavy, like, I get sometimes the politics of it all are a little like a snooze fest and I want to get back to Ahsoka slicing up droids and that kind of thing. But he's done a good job at kind of explaining that the Republic, like, inherited a lot of the machinery, the bureaucracy of the Empire, that obviously the Empire was being run by an evil person. It engaged in slavery and murder and embezzlement and all kinds of bad stuff. But the Republic wasn't some shining city on a hill. You know, it was, you know, there was red tape. They were, you know, basically saying, like, not everyone who was in the Empire was truly evil. Not everyone who worked for the Republic was really good. Mm-hmm. So, and then this kind of another thing, this like unbroken cycle of Republic, Empire, Republic, Empire, Republic, Empire, which Balin talk not in this episode, but in future episodes, we'll talk about and how he's trying to break that cycle, which is part of what makes that character so interesting. And I'm so excited to see where it goes. But yeah, I think the subtle hints and kind of subtext of this episode about that is good. In future episodes, when there's like these Republic hearings and Hera has to testify, it gets a little bogged down in the politics of it. But I do appreciate that Filoni is trying to bridge this multi-year gap between the fall of the Empire and the ascent of the New Republic, and how it wasn't just so black and white.
Mm-hmm. And I, you know, you can see it in there in the wardrobe choices, the design. Like the New Republic, say what you will about the Empire, but their fashion sense is way better than the New Republic.
That's for
it's,
sure.
It's stark. It's imposing. It's not, you know, it's literally very like gray and black and white. And it's obviously based off of Nazi uniforms, which were, weren't they famously designed by like Hugo Boss or something like that? Like the Nazi uniforms were,
oh, I don't know.
That might be apocryphal. I'll do some quick research in a second, but I just want to say like, the New Republic uniform, terrible, terrible fashions. It's like this light blue on like dookie brown color. The only one that looks any good, and again, I'm keeping it classy here, is Hera Syndulla, who is just straight up poured into them orange jumpsuit pants, and her bomber jacket. But like, she looks great. The rest of the New Republic, they look goofy. Their uniforms are goofy, and I think what it is, I think it's another deliberate choice where it's like a psyop kind of thing. Like those colors are meant to be soothing and they're meant to show you like we are a kinder, gentler government militarocracy. And we're not, you know, we're not the Empire. We're the exact, we have a pop of color in our stuff. But it's like, it looks awful. It's an eyesore.
Yeah, and some of the helmets inherited from, I guess you think of those.
Those helmets have always been terrible in like the original trilogy. Like,
yep,
just
and
the
Blockade Runner.
The Rebels have always had really bad fashion sense, except on an individual level. Like overall, their quote unquote, their slapdash uniforms, because that's kind of the point. Is they don't really have a quote-unquote uniform when they're the Rebel Alliance. It's just, like, whatever we can find. And when you get into higher levels of, like, you know, Leia's ship, the Blockade Runner and all that, yeah, there's some uniformity, but overall, doesn't look great compared to what the Empire's doing with their image.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I'm trying to think. So that whole like Imperial Republic cycle stuff was good, and it culminated in that really fun fight scene where Ahsoka takes on an HK droid and Darth Sir Galabad, which I'm stealing from my wife, who's like that one Inquisitor who looks like a character out of Demon Souls. You know what I'm talking about?
Marok.
Yes.
Marok.
Yeah. So she fights with them. She slices up the HK droid. She's clearly more than a match for Marok, who escapes. There's this badass scene. I'm sure anyone who's seen that episode remembers it, where he throws his double-bladed lightsaber at her, runs away, jumps onto Darth Billie Eilish's ship, and then he, like, pulls it back. And Ahsoka, without looking, just kind of, like, slightly moves her shoulder. And how badass can Ahsoka be? And the blade returns.
Chef's kiss.
Right? And then you get some great chopper stuff. But I think this episode is really just setting up the maps back on that Cetos planet, the hyperdrive cores back on that planet. Everyone's going to start converging on that planet. Are they going to make the jump to that new galaxy? So I think this episode, first episode's kind of setting the stage for the season. And this episode kind of felt like it was setting the stage for kind of the mid-season climax.
Yeah, it's the... It's introducing us to the idea that there are two galaxies,
yeah,
and that they're parallel, and that there's something called the Pathway to Peridia, and Cetos is the Red Tree Planet, where they're going to like use the sphere thingy and put it in the sphere holder thingy, and it shows us that the pathway, which that's when I think Baylan and Shin have that conversation about like, where's this going? Like, what are, you know, what's the end goal here? And Baylan says to her, it's another really cool exchange where he's like, you know, what is the, I think she asks him like, when we get Thrawn back, like, what does that mean for us? And he's like, well, for some, it, I wrote it down. For some, war. For others, a new beginning.
Mm.
And she asks for us, and he says, power such as you've never imagined.
Yeah,
which I don't even think, like, that's relevant to Thrawn. It's just like, you know, this whole Thrawn thing, whatever, that's more, our boss, Morgan, is interested in him. We're going to get to where she wants to go to get that guy, but that's going to be irrelevant once we get there, because there's something even greater that they're not even looking at.
I love that exchange. Textbook enigmatic. And I love that. One thing that and we'll get to this in future episodes, I'm not, you know, like, there's a lot of Rebels DNA here. And I think Filoni has an interesting approach to this show, where there's a lot of familiarity, almost too much, right? We know these characters, we know their relationships, but at the same time, he's going to places we've never seen before in the Star Wars universe. And when we get to the finale of this first season, we can talk about this, but I've rarely been so excited to see where things go. So it's kind of a healthy dose of been there, seen there, been there, done that, and a heavy dose of I have no idea where this is going. And that not knowing is so thrilling. And Baylan is kind of a big part of that, because Baylan isn't like, I'm a Jedi, I'm a Sith. He has his own agenda, which I love, separate from, he's kind of along for the ride, but he's got his own thing he's going to do, and he sets that up with that line. And I like that this show also has a lot of gray characters. It's something that Star Wars needs more of. He's kind of a dark Jedi, you could call him that, or orange Jedi, you know, but he's not a Sith. He's not a Jedi.
Almost you could describe him as evil Obi-Wan Kenobi. Like, his look, his beard, you know, the white hair, the gray robes, like, he's almost evil Obi-Wan Kenobi, but he's not. The thing in that gives me pause is the word evil. I'm not even sure if he's quote-unquote evil.
That's I love that. He does have that presence and that command and that wisdom of Obi-Wan, even if it's being directed towards something. I hesitate to say nefarious, because I have a sense of what he's doing at the end of the season, but it's an interesting way to take a character. And I think Ahsoka herself is kind of this middle of the road character. I think the best thing they did with that character was have her walk away from the Order. It made her so much more interesting. And there's a lot of those gray characters in this show, which I'm excited about, because they don't follow the typical expectations of a virtuous or a villainous character.
Yeah, the fact that Ahsoka is not a Jedi, like, she's a former Jedi, like, the parallel between her and Baylan is so strong, and it's so interesting. And it's the thing that gives me pause when I want to say Baylan is evil, because is Ahsoka evil just because she walked away from the Jedi Order, just because she, you know, threw off the burden of following this strict monastic code? No. And she had her reasons. I think Baylan had his reasons. A couple other things that we see in like these first two episodes that I wanted to touch on. One is just a small visual thing. You've just finished watching Rebels, so like, you know that this might have been familiar to you. The Lothcats popping up in the long grass in like transition shots between one location, and it's like, now we're back on the Thal. long shots of these tall spires and like a Loathcat or two popping up out of the tall grass. It's such a cool little thing that like it. If you didn't watch Rebels, it happened all the time on Rebels, and it was just a nice little like, oh, we're back on this like planet. This is, we have things that we care about. This is people's homes, and there's these little lovable creatures. And another thing. Oh, and speaking of which, the Loathcats. I read some criticism about, like, the end of the show when Sabine is on this planet on another galaxy and she's stuck there for however long. Who's going to feed her Loathcat? And I actually have a theory about that. I think it's, like, an outdoor cat where, like, I think every time we've seen her Loathcat in these first two episodes, it's in her apartment. It's in her little watchtower thing. But I don't think it's, like, trapped in there. I think it's, like, a... Like, she has food for it, but I don't think it's her pet, necessarily. I don't think it relies on her to... Do you know what I'm talking about?
That's funny. I didn't think about it the first time, but rewatching it in episode two, I'm like, who's going to feed that damn Loathcat? Because I'm a cat person, and I'm the Loathcat, the puppetry on that, talk about chef's kiss.
I cannot, Evan, tell if it's CG
right.
or... an actual hand puppet. I just can't tell.
It's probably like Grogu, like a combination of the two or something like that. But whatever
I'm
it is.
I'm certain there's an answer to that, and we could probably look it up. So listeners, if you know, like write in and tell us, or we'll look it up. But looks so good.
It looks amazing. And the special effects in general in the show are pretty good. There are some blue screen, green screen effects that don't look as great as others. But in general, it looks pretty good.
And so one other thing is Ahsoka's, like, sensibility. I don't know if you've ever read any of the EU. I don't know if they're officially decanonized at this point, but, like, there's a book about Ahsoka. I think it's just called Ahsoka. Or any of the other books that she's appeared in, like, that are Clone Wars era or, you know, post. But she has this ability, and God, somebody out there knows the name of it. Please write in and tell me what it is. But it's like she can touch an object and she gets memories of anybody else that touched that object. She can like, they kind of show her doing it in these first two episodes. When she's on Planet Arcana, she like touches the orb and she's like hearing voices. But then when in this episode, in episode two, when she goes to where Sabine and Shin had a battle, she's kind of like just touching the ground and like hearing voices. So is that something you noticed or have you read any of those books? And do you know, like, that's like a kind of unique ability that Ahsoka has?
I definitely picked up on that in these last two episodes, especially because I had subtitles on. So I heard those voices coming through. I didn't make that connection. And I haven't read those EU books, but that makes a whole lot of sense that she has that ability because she deploys it, at least once in each episode.
Psychometry is what it's talking about. It's
okay.
It's called psychometry.
Interesting.
Yeah. Let me see if I can get like a quick definition of that because it's a wild word. It's a rare force ability that allows the user to sense the history of objects as well as the emotions the initial user was feeling. Psychometric.
Wow. Okay.
Ahsoka
just got even cooler.
Yeah. Hu Yang has a really cool, really fun moment where he walks in. After Sabine is like, we see her lightsaber wound, and he's like, oh, I see your repairs are complete.
Yes, that got a good chuckle. Tenet actually has some of the biggest laughs in the future episodes. That's just a really, really cool character who has centuries of experience and wisdom and is also a little cranky. So he and sometimes I wish, and we'll get to this in future episodes, sometimes I wish that like they pared down the show and it was just kind of like Ahsoka and Hu Yang traveling around the stars, kind of like Din Djarin and Din Grogu. That's my dream. But then we wouldn't get some of the weird, exciting stuff we get at the tail end of this season.
True. What do you think of Merrick overall? Like, who do you think Merrick is? Where did he come from? What is he? We get some answers later on, but, like, what's your overall take on Merrick?
So I just assumed he was, like, a holdover, a leftover from the Inquisitors. But then when he meets his end, is it the next episode or episode 4 from Ahsoka? And he, like, turns to dust? That threw me for a loop. Like, was he, like, revived? Was he dead and maybe revived by Dark Witch magic? So that's kind of still a big question mark for me.
Well, he for sure was. That green energy comes out of him.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And we've seen that in the Witches of Dathomir episodes of Clone Wars, where they I think General Grievous is attacking their planet.
I remember that episode.
And they use their magic to, like, resurrect all these Knight Brothers. And it's that same green magic shit that, like, flies around and reanimates their corpses. So we only get a few hints and things. Like, I feel like they were really teasing us with having this masked character. We were supposed to think, like, you know, oh, is this somebody that... you churned evil that we know from Rebels or we know from something else. All that speculation led nowhere. So I think all we get is, like, the design of his lightsaber. That's clearly, like, an Inquisitor lightsaber. This is the second thing that I was, like, really scared when it first came up, when it starts spinning. I'm like, don't do the helicopter. Don't fly away on your lightsaber, please.
Oh. Yeah,
that's something, like, I love Rebels, but every time the Inquisitors do that, I'm like, this is a little bit too much to wrap my mind around. It does pay off in the, like, him throwing it, and it boomerangs back, and like you said, Ahsoka just has that cool, like, just churns her shoulder moment. All we get is, like, I think, like, he was an Inquisitor. Somehow he survived all of the events of the original trilogy and the two Death Stars blowing up or maybe didn't survive, but, like, died in a way that his body was intact enough for Morgan to resurrect him as a zombie Inquisitor.
That makes sense.
It's a character that, like, I want to be interested in, but there's just not much to really dig into.
Agreed.
And he gets killed later on anyway, so who cares? It's kind of like, it's the, what was Gwendolyn Christie's character?
Oh, my God. Yeah, Phasma.
Phasma.
Talk about
Captain Phasma of this show.
I'm salty about a lot of things in the sequel trilogy, but that's up there. Just a wasted character. Very cool potential for a villain.
Yeah.
Just everything evaporated.
So that's what I've got for these two episodes. I do have my big three questions, so we'll get into those. But before we do, do you have any other notes on Ahsoka Part 1 and 2?
No, that hits it pretty well. I think... there is one other thing, just very quickly, and we'll get into this when I think maybe... Is it Thrawn or another character who calls Ahsoka a Ronin later on? But if you look at the dress, the makeup... the outfit of Ahsoka, she's got her lightsabers now have curved handles like a katana, and her shoes, she's wearing the Jikatabi, which are this Japanese style of footwear with, like, the divided toe, you know, like the big toe and then the other toes. She's got this like samurai Ronin thing going for it. I love it, and it kind of feeds into her character of being like a masterless samurai. And I hope that keeps building throughout the series. But that's one thing that caught my eye in these first two episodes that I hope expands into the next season.
And maybe you said this, but isn't there, like, a thing with, like, the short... She has, like, a long blade and a short blade, and the short one's called, like, a Shoto blade or something like that?
I wouldn't be surprised if that represents some kind of feudal Japanese, like, sword style, because that character very much feels like... a space samurai.
Yeah. All right. So my big loot, we brought in our resident singer, Ryan Lawler, to sing our theme song for Lose Big Three. Ryan, hit it.
Lose Big Three. It's you and me. We're going to have fun with Lose Big Three.
Thanks, Ryan. Phenomenal as always. That was actually, that little piece was scored by John Williams, a little known fact.
He's so prolific.
And Ryan added lyrics to it. So, okay, Lou's Big Three, number one. In Toil and Trouble, we get a great Hera and Chopper moment where they're back and forth about, like, you know, you got to put the tracker on the thing. We only get one chance at this. And he's, like, digging through all these spare parts and tossing them. And, you know, he's like, did you go through my stuff? And she's like, I didn't go through your stuff. And did you look under the whatever spare battery? And he's like, oh, yeah, there it is. Okay. So there's a bit of an exchange there where Chopper's like, ba, 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 ba. And she's like, no, we can't just shoot it down. Yep. It would crash into the port city. And Chopper goes, ba, ba, ba. What do you think that ba, ba, ba translates to? That specific one.
Oh, interesting. Well, Chopper, as you mentioned in a text conversation, Chopper is what, like, pure chaos? Right? He's just like, he's also, like, he's loyal to Hera. There's that amazing scene at the end of Rebels where he goes up and holds her hand after she's lost a loved one. Makes me cry. But he's also weirdly homicidal, like knocking droids out of, like, the cargo bay and just, like, electrocuting everyone and destroying ships. And so that was probably, like, and or something like that.
That's exactly what I heard. Sometimes when Chopper's talking, you can literally make out the words behind the ba-ba-bas. And this was one where I'm like, that's, you heard the exact same thing I did, which was, yeah, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm reading this, like, note real quick. Chopper's body count is estimated to be over 4,000 and perhaps as high, 50,000.
Is this on Wikipedia?
Yeah, pretty much the only person that you might be able to say has a higher kill count than Chopper is, like, Grand Moff Tarkin for, like, firing the laser on Alderaan.
Chopper, such a wonderful addition to the Star Wars canon. I love him. Love him to death.
Yeah, and his back and forth with Hera is always just perfect. Do you know that Chopper and Hera, this is old hat, listeners, I'm sure, like, a lot of people know this, but that they have a cameo in Rogue One.
That I didn't know. I'll have to go back and watch that.
Oh, it's great. It's a little tiny thing. They have two moments where they pop up. One is at some point, Jyn and Andor are on, like, Yavin 4, and you hear, like, somebody over the PA system be like, General Syndulla, report to the whatever. And you actually see Chopper, like, rolling in the background. It's the first time we see, like, a live-action appearance of Chopper. And then during the battle over Scarif, you see the ghost come in and take out, like, three TIE fighters, like, in a single laser shot. Because Hera's just awesome. And
wow.
Anyway.
Absolutely going to go back and look for those.
Oh, it's a good excuse to go back and watch Rogue One again. It's the best Star Wars movie. Fight me. Lou's Big Three, number two. This is kind of a big question. But in your mind, you play Dungeons & Dragons.
Sure.
And I'm going to, like, bear with me because this is going somewhere. Do you feel like Morgan Elsbeth's witch magic and the Dathomir Night Sisters, like, witch magic, which is usually, like, coated with green shit coming out of their hands or coming out of wherever. What's the difference / similarity between that and the Force? Is it the same thing and it's different names for it? Or is it an entirely different, like, source of magic?
I've actually thought about this a lot, increasingly since watching Ahsoka, because they introduced the Night Sisters in Clone Wars, right? And they use magic, and that was magic in Star Wars. I mean, Star Wars has always straddled the line between sci-fi and fantasy, and the Force is sort of magical anyway, but true magic seemed alien in an alien universe. And I've always wondered, like, is it tapping into the Force or tapping into some other primal energy? And then I thought about it more and more as we're introduced to kind of the origins of the Night Sisters, I guess, in the end of Rebels 2.0, Ahsoka. I think it's a different source of power, a different, like, a rival to the Force. And that's what makes it so scary, so alien, so exciting, that they're tapping into something. Like, I think by now, any Star Wars fan worth their salt understands kind of the contours of the Force, the what it does, what it can't do, what it means, the living Force, the, you know, all that stuff. This magic stuff boggles my mind. I can't wrap my head around it, which is, I love not knowing. So I think it's a different source of power, and maybe it has its its origins in this other galaxy, but I think it's discrete. It's independent from the Force. What do you think?
The reason I brought up Dungeons and Dragons, and listeners, I apologize to put you in a box, but like I'm assuming you're a nerd, and I'm assuming if you're into Star Wars, you may or may not also be into D&D, nerds. So in Dungeons and Dragons, you have like, let's say like a warlock, right? Their magic comes from a patron, like, you know, a powerful god or demon or something that they literally make a pact with, you make a deal with, and you get to use some of their magical power. And that's where you can cast certain spells from. Versus like a wizard or a sorcerer, their magic comes from a different source called the Weave. And there's like this goddess Mistra, I think, that is like the weaver. And so if you're like a sorcerer or a wizard or whatever in the D&D realm, in the Forgotten Realms, your magic comes from that versus if you're a cleric or a paladin or a warlock. You have to like ask a certain deity for some of their power specifically in order to cast Sacred Flame or whatever like spell. So I think it's a similar thing here where, you know, if you're a Jedi or a Sith, you're tapping into the living Force. And I don't know, the Clone Wars did like a whole thing on like Mortis, right? The Mortis, the father and... Yes. The daughter and the son and like the dark side and the light side and the balance. And I think that is ties in, especially because this is a Dave Filoni thing. So I think when a Jedi or a Sith or anybody that's a Force user is using their power, they're tapping into the source from Mortis, let's say, just to simplify it, versus like a Night Sister, a Morgan Elsbeth, a witch. They're tapping into the source of power from Dathomir or from whatever planet they're going to, Peridia. I think just the fact that it's coded in different colors, like it's oversimplifying it, but I don't think it's just the same magic with different names. I do think it's a different source of magic. So
yeah.
I'm glad you agree with that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, Lose Big Three, number three, Baylan, what do you think, how do I word this? What do you think made Baylan the way that he is now? What do you think, like, happened to him? Specifically, I think, okay, I want to touch on, like, where do you think Baylan was during Order 66 and... the immediate, like, year or two following that?
So I think Baylan was relatively... So we meet Kanan Jarrus, Caleb Doom, during Order 66, and he's, what, like, 12, 13, 14, something like that, still relatively young. This is a character from Rebels, for those who are uninitiated. I think, in my headcanon... I think Ray Stevenson. What was that character's name again? Baylan Skull.
Baylan Skull.
I think Baylan was older, maybe like early 20s. So more trained, more equipped. Probably still had a master, or his master was in his life, but probably killed, probably murdered. Lost everything he knew, everything he loved, and was kind of a journeyman for a while, I think, taking odd jobs maybe. And I think in the years after Order 66, probably it it built up in him this like resentment of like the rigidity of the order, the how like Empire, Republic, it's all the same. It's this cycle of death and rebirth, and he's tired of it. He's sick of it and wants to make a change. Wants to break that cycle. He says as much in future episodes. So I think he was like an older Padawan. Maybe he was a knight at that. Maybe he didn't have a master, didn't yet have a Padawan. And just kind of went in and looked after himself for those first few years. But that's kind of my headcanon. What about you?
Yeah, very similar. I have a lot of like fanfic in my head of this character.
Yeah.
And it's all just me imagining stuff. But yeah, I think like I get the sense that, you know, from the way he talks about like it will be a shame to kill Ahsoka because there's so few Jedi left and, you know, it's just the truth. Like the way he talks about that and he has this sadness in his eyes. I think he wishes things had gone a different way. I think he wishes that the Jedi Order hadn't made a lot of the mistakes that they made and been so blind to Palpatine. I get the sense that, like, during Order 66, just because of his age, he probably wasn't an apprentice anymore. He probably was, like, a knight, yeah. Maybe even a master. And he probably had, just like General Kenobi, just like General Skywalker, like, probably had a Rex or a Cody or like a small group of clones that he cared for. And they probably tried to kill him and he had to slaughter them to save his life.
Mm.
And that probably changed him on a deep level. And he never came back from that. And he's like tottering somewhere between like, I want things to go back the way they were and the truth of knowing that they never can. I've already, you know, had to do things to survive. And there are just these greater things that were out of my control. And I think that's what is making him want to seek power. He wants to have power in order to never have to commit atrocities in order to, like, keep the peace or to, I don't know, who knows?
Yeah,
it's all speculation.
It's a great character, though. They achieved a lot with him with very little screen time in season one. And it's his arc that I'm most interested in heading into season two.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Evan, I got a quick bonus question
before
we get into our discussion of the new Dave Filoni show. So you may remember that we always do like a little bit of recasting fun. It used to be with two different actors, Danny DeVito and Whoopi Goldberg,
yeah.
But I feel like we've done so many permutations of that, and so now the question is, Evan, if we were to recast Ahsoka with John Cena and Angela Bassett, which characters would you cast them as, and in what ways would that improve Ahsoka?
Wow, that's a curveball. Well, Cena is... Obviously, he's got he's imposing physically, but he's also got a funny side to him. He's naturally funny. So it's a shame to just limit, because he's so imposing physically, to limit him to just a voice. But I think I would make John Cena the voice of Chopper, because he's just naturally funny. And kind of has that sharpness to him. And then Angela Bassett, oh boy. So I would say, have we met her yet in these first two episodes? Okay, I might cheat. I'll tell you who my first one is, which is kind of a cheat, and then I'll say my second choice. First would be Mon Mothma. I think Angela Bassett would be, but we haven't technically met her in these first two episodes, I don't think. So that's kind of a cheat.
Okay.
So my second pick would be Morgan Elsbeth, because she's, talk about just imposing and steely and focused and driven, and Bassett could nail that. And she wouldn't smirk as much either, which I would appreciate. So those are my picks.
Yeah, I got the same one for Angela Bassett. Morgan Elsbeth, it's a home run.
That's a slam dunk.
Again, I don't want to take it away from Inosanto. She's fantastic. But, like, if we have to recast and put Angela Bassett somewhere, that's the perfect slot there. With John Cena, it's... Man, that's a tougher one, actually. But maybe I'm leaning towards Merrick, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, if John Cena is famously invisible, and, you know, Merrick always wears a helmet, so you don't see him. And yeah, he just in the one cool moment that Merrick gets, it's when like Ahsoka jumps through some glass and is running, and then out of nowhere, Merrick is there to stop her. So. You know, that's a very John Cena thing.
Yeah, that's a good pick, too.
All right. So, listeners, thank you for staying tuned so far. As we promised, Evan and I, actually, we received screeners from Dave Filoni himself. Privacy reasons, I can't say, like, what my relationship is to Dave Filoni. Just suffice to say that he trusted us as podcasters with taking an exclusive look at the newest Disney Plus show that's
right.
coming down the pipeline, possibly this fall. And he sent us the first episode that we watched. And I just want to set up like the synopsis for this show. It's pretty surprising, and it's probably not what you're expecting. So do you know, in episode 7, The Force Awakens... No, wait, I'm sorry. That's wrong. In episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker...
That's right.
Yeah, there's the whole plot point that, like, Palpatine was resurrected, and he's on Exegol, and he's, you know, he's the man behind the curtain this whole time, bringing about the First Order. And Poe Dameron has that famous line, somehow Palpatine returned. It turns out, we found out from watching this new show, that people have misinterpreted that line, because they think that it's, like, somehow, comma, Palpatine returned. No. What it is that somehow Palpatine is Sheev Palpatine's cloned brother, and that they had all of these crazy misadventures before the original trilogy, Sheev and somehow the Palpatines. And so this show, this new Disney Plus show, is focusing on these two brothers living in an apartment on Coruscant or wherever. And it was Coruscant, right?
It was a high-rise apartment on Coruscant.
That's right, okay. And I'm excited to see where it goes. We've only gotten the first episode so far, but there are 4 episodes so total. So we're going to be able to talk about one of each of them on these episodes here. So we're going to talk about the first one now. We're waiting for them to send us the DVD of the next one, or the maybe digital copy, hopefully, so we get it in time. But yeah, Evan, what did you think of the first episode of Sheev and Somehow?
Yeah, I think it's building towards something pretty cool. It's like a different side of Palpatine with his clone brother. It's kind of like a modern, well, I shouldn't say a modern, kind of a sci-fi version of The Odd Couple. You know, they have this palatial apartment in Coruscant. It's big, but even with them cohabitating, it leads to a lot of hijinks. You know, Palpatine, Emperor, very focused on order. You know, he likes to keep the place clean. Somehow, bit of a slob. You know, lets the dishes pile up in the sink. Palpatine doesn't like that. So it leads to those kind of those hijinks.
Yeah, there was a whole, like almost half the episode was about them, like, arguing about making a chore wheel and, you know, whose churn is it to clean the bathroom. And the big question I kept asking was, like, why don't they just get a droid to do it?
Yeah, there's those kind of plot holes in it. It also was kind of disappointing that to settle the argument, Sheev electrocuted somehow with the Force lightning. That seemed kind of like a cop-out.
He always resorts to that, you know, but somehow calls him out on it. He's like, because the biggest point of contention, and I think this is where the season is really going. Because I, you know, obviously until episode 9, somehow, disappears until he comes back. Somehow Palpatine returns in episode 9. So all this time we wonder, like, where did he go? And I don't, I obviously Sheev didn't kill him, but I do think that tension is born from the fact that, like, somehow doesn't have those lightning powers. He was a clone, but I guess, like, something got botched, and he didn't have force powers. And I think that's, like, the major source of tension between the two brothers.
Yeah, and I think that's prime territory to explore that, right? Because Sheev has this natural advantage over him, and he can just kind of bully him. So I'm hoping in the future there'll be more tender moments where, you know, Sheev comes back from a long day at, you know, being evil, and somehow who has, you know, his telemarketing job just works at home. That there'll be those moments where they kind of come home and they have like a they treat each other more as equals. Mm-hmm. I'm hopeful we get that more throughout the season.
Well, the strength of it is that they look identical, even if they don't have the same powers. They look identical, and they use that to their advantage. Because in this era, this takes place during the prequel era. Obviously, Sheev has not revealed himself to be a Sith, so he can't just use his powers in public. But you know, so I did like how they had that sitcom mishap where Sheev was supposed to deliver like a keynote speech to the Senate at the same time. Somehow was supposed to go on a date with this woman, for this like Twi'lek, and they, for whatever reason, like their schedules didn't match up and there was like a mix up, and so they had to switch places, and nobody was any the wiser because they had to like, you know, somehow had to improvise a speech on the Senate floor, and Sheev had to somehow pretend to have like person skills and make this date work. And it all kind of worked out in the end, though.
Yeah, it was interesting, kind of a twist, because somehow really only knows about telemarketing. He managed to actually pass a sweeping bill through the Senate to enhance the telemarketing budget on Coruscant. So that was kind of a cool twist. And then, the seduction scene with Sheev and that Twi'lek dancer was a little awkward, but it all worked out in the end.
It did. Well, it worked out in the sense that he took her to like a back alley and electrocuted her to death and dumped her body down a pit. But that's the kind of evil thing that we expect from Sheev. And I like they're like planting those seeds early.
Yeah, that's that episode definitely earned the TV MA rating. Because of that ending, mm-hmm. kind of took a weird left turn there. But, you know, he is a Sith. He is evil. Can't really blame him for it.
Yeah, it's what's exciting is, like, in the next episode, how he's going to explain that to somehow, you know? But we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I'm excited to see how it turns out. Sheev and somehow, they're on the rise.
Mm-hmm. Good theme song, too. Really fun theme song.
Yeah, they got Randy Newman to do it, I think. He was really born to score this show.
Yep, it makes me laugh just thinking about those. Some of the lyrics are so good. I don't have a clip, but we'll have something for you maybe next week. So listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to our coverage of Ahsoka. We are Robots versus Dinosaurs. I have been your host, Louis G, with my intrepid co-host, Evan. And we are going to be back next week to talk about episodes 3 and 4. So thanks for tuning in. And may the Force be with you.
And with you.
Tong's days, am I right?
Protocol droid for the win.
The New Republic uniform, terrible, terrible fashion.
Darth Billie Eilish and her robots with capes.
You're supposed to be my brother-in-law, Anakin.
We were going to go to family business together, Anakin.
I would have seen you at the reunion, Anakin.
Are you just asking for hate mail right now?
You can go to the space prom.